You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 251 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's show, we dig deep into the archives of the British cooperatively owned department store John Lewis, which celebrates its 150th anniversary this week.
And Jacob Soule will be with us to discuss his new book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Making and Breaking of Nations.
And if that's not enough, the illustrator George Butler will discuss why illustration and not photography is his medium of choice for war reporting.
That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Andrew, what a week it's been here at Midori House.
It's been a bit crazy, but then it always is.
But you've been, can I say you've looked serene, but busier, even I would say, than normal. Is that a fair characterisation?
Yes, it's been a lot.
It's been a kind of an intensity.
Yes, we finished the next issue, which is a good one. We had our transport editor here, Tristan McAllister, who's going to pop in a minute.
He's going to stop by. I'd be interested to hear from him. See what he's going up to.
So he's normally based in New York. He came over to London because we've been doing a transport survey. We've been still revving the engines on finishing the second Monocle book, which isn't far off.
That is exciting.
So yes, it's been busy.
It has been busy.
And I've got a dicky knee.
What, how have you managed to do that?
I don't know. It just happened. I had to go and get it taped up. So I've been walking around with like a strange gait. I don't mean like a gait to a field, holding it in my hands.
I thought you were some kind of John Wayne tribute stroll that was taking place. But now it's all explained. Well, we've got a pretty exciting show. Are you looking forward to it?
I am. We've asked people to bring things in with them, so I hope that they do.
I'm hopeful that we should have some
ruffling
nice cultural artefacts, yes, and a bit of that kind of thing occurring later.
Good. Well, should we perhaps start the show?
I think we should. Should we start by looking ahead to next week?
Let's do that.
It is indeed time, Andrew, for us to look, to look ahead. It's the news look ahead. And
it's the new news look ahead.
It is the new news look ahead. As usual, I like to ease myself into the chair for this one.
And if you're not here, we normally have an American, Danny. But he's not here.
He's not here either.
We've got another American. We've got Tristan, all the way here from New York.
It's a look ahead. I'm clairvoyant, so I can handle this.
Tristan McAllister, you are, of course, our transport editor sitting in New York. But you came to London, and not just because it's your birthday this week.
No, indeed not. It's also closing week for this issue, or actually the forthcoming June issue, which will, of course, house the transport survey.
Yes.
That must be an exciting time. Do you sort of look forward to that? It's kind of like that moment where, you know, Superman goes into the little thing and spins around and comes out in his...
It's my reason for being,
Transport
Tom.
Man.
My reason for being. I live for this.
Do you have a cape?
Unfortunately, I don't really need one because I have plenty of jets around me all the time.
That is true. Oh. That is true. See what he's done there.
And expenses all his bus tickets.
We've seen it.
Okay, where are you going to start with this news? Okay, you do understand how this works, don't you? You tell us the news over the next week. What are we going to start with?
Well, this one is something that I've been following for a while. Next week will, at least according to the Qatari, the international airport will open in Doha. This is... been a long time coming. They told us last year, actually last April, in fact, it would open. Flight inbound, all the press there flagged it off, said, sorry, you can't land. We're not ready for you. Sent them to the old airport, the airport that's still in operation, saying now the new one will open next week. And if everything goes according to plan, then we'll see a new airport.
And do we know why they didn't open? It just wasn't ready?
Well, there are lots of theories on this. At the time, they had said that it just wasn't ready in terms of security, that they had actually done sweeps of the airport. They knew it wasn't ready to handle jets. Also, there were rumors going around, at least very early on, that some minor details like the jetways actually pointing in the wrong direction were issues.
Now, can I query your use of the expression minor details?
Well, you know, I think they chalked it up to minor
to
problems,
major, perhaps.
But it's pretty big. So
no wonder they got flagged off.
Been a very long time coming.
I'd have been flagged off.
I think everyone would have been. And what will we expect if this long-awaited development does happen then? What will we find there, Tristan? Is this exciting? Is it going to be pushing boundaries airports-wise, or is it going to do a lot of things that maybe we would expect it to be able to do.
Well, it's become a bit of a pissing match for the big urban centers in the Middle East, you know, especially the ones with airlines. You know, we're talking about Qatar Airways, we're talking about Emirates, and of course Etihad and Abu Dhabi, but these airports have become sort of these showpieces for how cool we are, how big we are, and how much we can flex our muscle on the world stage. So this is a really big deal, and of course it's all part of the run-up to the World Cup, which is forthcoming in Doha as well. So it all sort of runs together, but there's also lots of sort of labor stories and things going wrong with the build-up to this. So this is just another part of that saga.
The other interesting thing is, I guess, that there's so much rivalry along the Gulf, isn't there? You know, Dubai wants to be the hub, you know, and if Qatar is building this, what's your opinion? Do you think that, you know, it is kind of build it and they will come? That just the amount of money and the amount of planes that these airlines are buying, that all of those hubs can coexist so close to each other?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, the way we've seen air travel grow in terms of demand, in terms of sort of a social mobility, a rising middle class that can actually afford to travel, that's where the Middle East sees itself really pulling ahead. These airports, especially Dubai, for instance, is building Dubai World Central that literally they say will be one of the biggest, most ridiculous airports you have ever seen. The CEO at Emirates has said they can reach 90% of the world with some of the new long-haul jets that they'll be purchasing, and some of their existing fleet as well. So that really puts them in line to dominate in terms of air travel. But yes, competition is an issue. There is a lot of concentration there, but I think demand, at least at this point, is showing that the competition is not that big of a deal.
That's pretty good. That was pretty interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what next?
Where should we go next?
Well, now that we've spent plenty of time talking about that, I thought this was sort of interesting, and of course, comparing it to here in the UK, I'm not necessarily sure what the ages are, but the New York City Council is going to raise the tobacco purchasing age to 21. I don't know what the age here is in the UK, but this is sort of a funny story because they say it'll cut down on youth smoking and, you know, on and on and on. But I still don't necessarily see how it will do that.
I'm always rather dubious about that because part of the appeal is supposedly, oh, you know, it makes me look older, you know, so on, et cetera, et cetera. And you put the age up, it makes you look even older, if you follow that logic.
Now, I don't smoke, but you have to be 18, I think, to smoke here.
Oh, we don't know. Isn't that terrible? I don't actually know. I thought it was always 16. Maybe it did go up to 18.
I think it's 18 years old.
Has that worked? Are fewer people smoking?
I don't know many 18-year-olds. So
well, but no. What they're
to
saying,
ask for a cigarette.
What they're saying...
I'll go do a survey afterwards.
What they're saying in New York is that 19,000 high school students under the age of 18 currently smoke, which to me signifies that some sort of line of thinking that there's no way that it's going to solve the problem because you have to be 18 to buy them now, but people are still getting them under 18. I don't see it really.
And as alarming as that statistic is, that's not that enormous an amount of people, is it? I mean, 20,000 is quite a large number, but you're talking out of probably what, many hundreds of thousands?
8 million people.
Millions even in that.
Yeah, but that's only high school, yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's something that's interesting. Staying sort of on that note, at least in the U.S., we have the forthcoming White House Correspondents Association dinner in Washington, D.C. Always a very interesting event. Of course, the president attends, and the glitterati of the media and everywhere else in the news world sort of come, and they all get together and put down their arms and sort of have fun and have jabs at one another.
But this is the president's chance to kind of turn the tables a bit, isn't it? He gets to make a funny speech.
Right, he does. But and oftentimes he is funny. Last year, you know, really pulling no punches when he was speaking about things like Donald Trump and that crazy sort of birther issue that was pretty prominent in the last election. But there's also a lot of criticism that comes along with this dinner every year. Last year, for instance, Tom Brokaw, a well-respected evening news anchor for years in the U.S., came out. He was actually on the original board that put together the correspondents' dinner, and he wasn't happy with the way things had gone. He thought it felt a little too loosey-goosey. He thought it was a little bit too much like everyone was sort of in bed with one another. And, you know, I think that's a really valid concern.
In bed with each other? Always a valid concern. Especially if you're about to get flagged off. You have to be very, very careful. And I hear the pudding wasn't as good last year as well.
Exactly. You might need a cigarette afterwards. Well, provided you're over 21, of course.
Well, and if you want to continue on the being flagged off theme.
I think we should.
Okay, well, then here's another one for you. The British Snoring and Sleep Apnea Association is holding National Stop Snoring Week. That's essentially a group of volunteers who will get together with a bunch of methods, including... a ball in the back of your pajamas.
Oh, a ball in the back. I tell you, that's always stopped me. Whenever I feel the snore coming on, I say, ball in the bag. That will cure me. And it does. Yeah. Every single time.
You don't want to flag anybody off. So, but they're also saying drinking milk, eating horseradish.
I'll always flag someone off after the ball in the bag.
Drinking milk, eating horseradish, gargling with garlic will solve your snoring.
I wonder where you're going with that one.
Well, I think that's almost enough, don't you?
That was exceptional, Tristan. Thank you very much. I'm glad that we flew in at great first-class flights across the Atlantic to share those insights into next week's news with us here on The Weekly. Tristan McAllister, thank you very much. Will you visit us again soon?
Hopefully.
Oh, I think that was a no. The British department store John Lewis is celebrating its 150th year this coming week. It's perhaps an unconventionally successful British brand. Launched in 1864 as a single drapery shop on central London's Oxford Street, it's grown into an icon of the British retail scene, both traditional to those who favour its tastes and forward-looking in its corporate structure.
John Lewis is a cooperatively owned business whose staff benefit from their company's growth and whose executives have held their focus by avoiding the distractions of mergers and acquisitions. It has stuck to its guns very successfully. Well, with us to recall the stories of its 150 years and its success is Chief Archivist for the John Lewis Group, Judy Faraday. Judy, thank you very much for coming to see us. And there's a very handsome book here on the table that we're going to talk about in a minute. But actually looking at that book and looking at the history of John Lewis, just take us back. So it started on Oxford Street, and I know you have this amazing store there now. So are you kind of still in the same location where it all began?
Yes, indeed we are. I think we're probably the oldest business still on its original site in Oxford Street. The building that we're in now, obviously, is a result of the bombing in 1940, which meant the building had to be pulled down. The original building was pulled down. And we now have a new building, if you can call it new. It was opened in 1960. And it still remains exactly on the same site as we were in 1864.
Judy, it always intrigues me when talking about John Lewis, this idea of the heritage. And Andrew alluded to it in the introduction there, that the sense of sort of shared ownership, obviously, that members of staff had. Is it something that's sort of taught to people? Do they call on you with your knowledge of the history and of the archives to impress that sort of heritage on maybe new members of staff who join? Or is it so prevalent, it's so apparent everywhere that actually it doesn't need to sort of be taught because people sort of get an instant understanding of it almost?
I think there is two different ways of looking at it. For people who come in from outside the business, then yes, obviously we do try to let them know a little bit about how the business was set up and its organisational structure, because it helps people then understand why we do things the way we do. However, it has been a co-owned business since 1929, and therefore the culture of the partnership is very much ingrained in everything that we do. And after a while, you do tend to absorb a lot of that culture.
And tell me, that idea of being owned by the staff seems radical today even. Many companies have thought about it. There are some co-ops around the world, for example, that have this idea of shared ownership. Tell us how it began at John Lewis.
Well, the original John Lewis shop was set up by a typical Victorian employer. Mr. John Lewis was very much the owner and surveyor of his business, and he would have spent very little time really in considering the thoughts and wishes and hopes and aspirations of his staff, because in the Victorian period that really wasn't the way that business was done. However, he had a son, and his son John Speedon Lewis, who took over from him on his death in 1928, then was able to start putting in the ideas that he had about changing the way the business was run. So he was the one who, in fact, turned it from an ordinary traditional business into the co-owned business that we have today.
Let's sort of delve a bit then into that history. It always intrigues me with company archives, because sometimes you think of these sort of files of, dry box of documents, and it can all be a bit uninspiring. But looking at this incredible book, which Andrew mentioned already, there's obviously such a wealth of material. Tell us a little bit about what we would find in the archive and what's actually there.
Well, you would find lots of rows of very boring brown boxes. Let's not make any bones about it. An archive is there to preserve the documents and records that are in there. So for every archive, there must be a place where they're kept securely and safely. And the best way of doing that is under archival conditions. However, when you take the lid off the boxes, that's when you find the real stories. And it's not just the stories that you find in the documents and the photographs that we have, but we have around 12,000 retired members of staff who have a fantastic knowledge about the business and how it grew up. And a lot of them deposit things for us into the archive and help us to build a much better picture of how the business grew up. And it's really fascinating to see some of the things they come across.
And the book, you've brought us in a limited edition version. There's 150, I believe, these made. And it has wonderful things. You can pull out letters and there are plans for the building. How long did it take you to put all this together?
Well, we've been really lucky. We've had a really good team of people behind the 150-year anniversary. Obviously, there have been different things created for different purposes. I mean, the book is one area that we've used, and that was mainly to give journalists and the media an idea of the type of things that we would be looking at and the sort of stories that we had. However, we've also created another book, and we've had Jonathan Glancy to write that book for us on the history of the business. So that will be available in the shops. So anybody could buy that and get a better idea about how the business has grown.
Could you tell me one thing which fascinated me as I looked through here? There's a story, I was just looking at a page which was about Peter Jones, another store that was bought by the John Lewis Partnership. And then there was the story of Jessop's, another department store out of London that you purchased. What struck me was it was very slow to kind of make everything John Lewis and to kind of imprint its brand very heavily on the things that it owned. Why was that, do you think?
Well, Peter Jones was and always will be Peter Jones. All the other shops now are obviously branded as John Lewis shops. But if you go back to the time when we acquired those businesses, most of our large department stores were acquired in 1940. And they already had their very independent characters and their own names. And it was decided at that time that that was a very good representation of the type of thing you would find in the shop. So that we decided not to change that. But when you get into the sort of society we have today, when everything is branded, it's very difficult to brand 30 different department stores. It really does need a central focus. So the decision was made over a period of a few years to change them from their original names back to John Lewis.
Judy, it intrigues me. I wonder the sort of approaches, I guess, during a big sort of anniversary year like this one, it's a lot of press just wanting to sort of write pieces about, you know, the model, what makes it unique. In the sort of day-to-day work, though, of the archive, do you find you get a lot of approaches from people who may be running other businesses who are intrigued to try and tap into a bit of the sort of the magic dust, if you like, that surrounded John Lewis? Or is it usually journalists who want to write about the store itself and its story? Or is it, do you find that people from other businesses who want to try and maybe understand maybe how they could do run their own businesses better?
I mean, there's always been a lot of interest in the partnerships model. Some people will come to us and find out from us exactly how we've done it. Other people, we suggest if they are another business and they're looking at adopting our model, it's a very unusual model and it doesn't suit everybody. So we suggest that perhaps they might try the Employee Ownership Association, and they're very good then at directing them and suggesting to them ways that they might adopt maybe some of the things that John Lewis does, not necessarily all of them. But we also get lots of academic researchers and people like that. So I think with more interest in the archive and with the interest in the model of the business, then we're going to see more people inquiring one way or the other to try and see if there's another way of doing business.
Do you think that is it possible to replicate the model, do you think, completely? Or is there something just unique that's perhaps sort of unmatchable? I mean, I guess maybe you would say that, but...
Well, it was a creature of its time. I mean, it was set up in 1929 and the man who set it up was very extraordinary. And I suppose when he had his initial ideas, we're talking about things like the rise of the British Labour Party, communism in Europe, the emancipation of women, all those ideas about the changing ways in society. So I'm sure they had something to do with the reason that he came up with his ideas. And perhaps, well, obviously now things have changed a great deal, but I think there is now even more of an interest in possibly looking at business in a slightly different way. So perhaps it's going to come round again. But I think, as I say, people do need to look at what bits of the John Lewis model would suit them best.
I wanted to ask you about the version of Britishness that John Lewis represents. You know, I think when we think of department stores, if we think of Harrods, if we think of Liberty, we think of a certain kind of person that goes there. John Lewis has a much broader reach, but it seems to really be about who middle-class Britons are. It says something about their aspirations and their desires. Has that always been the case? Was it very good at encapsulating a type of person?
I think we've always paid a great deal of attention to who our customers are and making sure that we can give them what they want, whoever that customer might be. So I suppose over the years, we have always tended to have a middle class, if you like to call it that, customer. But actually, over the years, I think our reach has broadened. I think we have a lot more. We used perhaps to be seen as a little bit maybe middle class, middle age, that sort of thing. But I think it's really changed. If you go into Oxford Street now, I think it's a really lively and interesting place to go to.
Well, I was going to say, I think probably every person in this building probably has white sheets and towels. and you know, there is a coming of age, isn't there? There's a point in your life where you discover that actually behind those doors are all the things you kind of wanted and done well and done in a great way. I just wanted to touch on one more thing before I bounce it back to Tom. Obviously, the Christmas commercial that's done by John Lewis has become something that people are literally waiting for the day that it's going to be aired. It's always a wonderful, touching extravaganza. And I thought it was very nice in this book. You've actually had a little dig at yourselves, which is, you know, that Private Eye did a kind of a spoof cover because it was about this wonderful bear that woke up this year. And on from the front of Private Eye, they had the boar and the snore, and the bear said, "I told you not to wake me up," and all the animals are slain around him. How important, because in the early days, of course, John Lewis was absolutely opposed to advertising, wouldn't do any of that kind of annoying stuff. And now you're at the epitome of how you can do great advertising.
Well, I think the great thing about advertising is that, you know, you have to be prepared to take what comes. You know, you can't give it and not be expected to take it. So I think we are a grown-up business. And if people want to poke fun at us about things like that, then we are big enough to take
it. And as archivists, it's your job to then put that in the folders.
Yeah. I mean, if you look in the archive, we're having a beautiful exhibition on the third floor of Oxford Street, which is going to open on the 3rd of May. And in there will be a cartoon that was drawn around 1900 of old Mr. John Lewis depicting him as a dinosaur in Holles Street. So it's, nothing has changed. You know, everything stays very much the same.
Wonderful stuff. Judy Faraday, Chief Archivist from the John Lewis Group, many thanks for coming to join us on The Weekly to talk us through the excitement of the 150th year celebrations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Andrew, I know that you very much enjoy talking about financial accountability, don't you?
Yes, I'm very keen on the double entry.
So we should set the scene for that discussion by maybe having some music first. Let's hear from Pink Floyd. This is Money.
That was Pink Floyd with Money.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
The 2007-08 global financial crisis told the tale of how the livelihoods of many were endangered by the actions of a few in financial services. But not all money men, bean counters, whatever you want to call them, should necessarily be tarred with the same brush.
As for our next guest, Jacob Soll argues, the role of the bookkeeper is essential, for good bookkeeping makes for good government. In his book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Making and Breaking of Nations, Soll explores the history of double-entry accounting and its impact on the ordering of economies and nations. Jacob Soll joins us from our New York bureau now. Jacob, thank you very much for joining us. Could you just tell us, you know, The task of making accounting sexy, as it were, must have been something that when you first knocked on the doors of publishers, they were a little bit unsure about. How did you sell this as the story that we needed to read?
Well, first of all, I didn't use the word accounting. I was warned against it. So I used the word accountability, which rang bells for everyone, since I think that everyone feels that there is some kind of pervasive financial unaccountability. And what happened was is I ended up showing them all these famous people who were accountants, from Cosimo de' Medici to Louis XIV's Minister Colbert to just Josiah Wedgwood, that accounting maybe wasn't sexy, but it was something that the smartest, most powerful people thought about, talked about, and in fact, great artists painted and wrote about for a very long time.
And I know that part of the argument of your book is, you know, that, as we were saying, good government comes from that accountability. And obviously you've already drawn the links with today. Do you feel that that's something that we're missing today? We've seen Enron, we've seen all these huge scandals come about where the failure to kind of, you know, look at a company's books, the dependency often on outside auditors who have let the public down as well. Did you feel that there was something there that just really needed to be, you know, put in a spotlight in a historical context?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, during the crisis, what struck me is we didn't talk about accounting. No one held up balance sheets. People didn't argue over them. In the 18th century, in the South Sea bubble, members of parliament actually did calculations about the company's returns, and they actually held up their calculations. They held up accounting sheets, and people argued about them. The prime minister argued about them. The financial press was born out of the publication of accounting sheets. And I was struck that in the 18th century, there was more discussion of this than there is now. And I thought, my gosh, we've actually moved backwards culturally.
Jacob, let me ask you about the sort of the things that undermine these good practices then. When you take that historical perspective and you look at today as well and the lessons we've learned even just in the last few years, is it a lesson that tells us that it's corruption or corrupt practices, corrupt thinking even, that's the problem? Or is it actually ineptitude rather than corruption, which is the real enemy?
Corruption is always going to be there. We know that from the birth of banking, money's made on the edges or around the edges of the law. I mean, that's the way it goes. There's a sort of pirate aspect to finance that we all know about. What's different, though, I think now, is the idea of people being literate in accounting. I mean, here we have a hyper-financial society, and most people don't know the basics of finance, which basically is double-entry bookkeeping. So we've got a great disconnect between what's going on in the world and our own culture and sort of knowledge set. I think we need to work on that. And the first thing to do is to actually recognize that something as mundane and seemingly boring as accounting is actually the linchpin to these great financial dramas.
And tell me, you talked a little bit earlier on about the South Sea Company and the South Sea bubble. And I think that in your book, you describe this as the first bailout there ever was.
Right.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that and the significance of that?
Well, what's amazing in the South Sea bubble is that both Robert Walpole and other members of parliament and members of the public all are literate in accounting. So they have debates about it. And when the bubble actually bursts and there's a crash, Walpole, who's a very skilled bookkeeper, can come up with a financial plan to bail out the South Sea Company, which continues going, to continue paying the country's debt, which is the big concern. And he's so clever that not only does he bail out the company and the debt situation of Britain, but he manages to cook the government's books and create a political slush fund. I know that sounds unfamiliar, but in America, you know, we've had something sort of similar. In France, they don't have any of those qualities. Their company goes under, the Mississippi Company goes under, the Royal Bank goes under, the stock market goes under, and their currency goes under, and they have series of bankruptcies after that. So even though Walpole was a slippery guy and a good accountant, he was still able to pull off this bailout and put Britain in a much better position than its neighbors.
Jacob, can I ask you then, why haven't the lessons of history been learned? Because I guess a lot of people will read the book and they'll be struck by the observations you make through this broad sweep of history, from sort of the city-states, the kind of powerhouses of the Middle Ages right through 18th century Britain, as you mentioned. Why does it seem that some of these broad lessons weren't learned? And how did the people with all of the technologies and the advances that they have at their fingertips in the last few years, as well as the historical perspective, of course, why do they keep getting things so wrong?
Well, I think some of the people who have the tools at their fingertips have learned the lessons and they're making a lot of money. I think that there has been a sort of grave crisis in the image of accountants. I mean, remember that even in Britain in the 18th century, there are still many paintings of accountants. The Baring brothers, other famous financiers and colonial businessmen, had themselves painted with their account books. This was something that was prevalent in Dutch society as well. We don't paint accountants anymore. We don't have great artists like and writers like Charles Dickens, who spends a lot of time talking about accounting. And you'll remember that Jacob Marley comes back in the chains of chains covered with his ledger books. Dickens always talked about accounting. So did Balzac. Other 18th and 19th century writers wrote about it all the time. We've forgotten this. It's not in our lexicon anymore. And I think that is part of the crisis, which is why I wrote this book.
Jacob, I wanted to ask you about that, Dickens being a Londoner. And there's quite a few references to him in your book. Was that a period, that period of Victorian England, where you know, the accountant, maybe not revered or celebrated, but was certainly seen as kind of central to kind of everything? You know, if you were going to be judged poor and sent to the poorhouse, or if you were going to be judged wealthy in society, it was your accountant that kind of stood between you and your reputation.
Well, I mean, this is Dickens' life, right? His father is a good accountant who is swindled by a bad accountant, and Dickens ends up in the Marshalsea prison, which inspires Little Dorrit, which I consider to be the greatest accounting book ever written, and financially perhaps one of the most sophisticated things ever done. Dickens struggles with accountancy because of its two sides, because of the honest, rational side and because of the possibility for fraud. We have good accountants like Micawber, and we have bad accountants doing evil things in the Circumlocution Office, in which all accounts go in but nothing comes out. So Dickens struggles with this new financial culture and the fact that it somehow doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And to understand, I think, our own problems, reading Dickens is really great, because he shows those two sides and he shows the tension. The one thing, though, that did emerge at the end of the 19th century was the accountant as this very respectable Sherlock Holmes-like fact bringer. That changes in the mid-20th century when accounting firms become aggressive profit-seeking entities.
Jacob, just to sort of come back to the present day again, I mean, no one painted a portrait of these sorts of characters as well as Dickens, but there are literally some portraits that you feature in the book in some of the plates of artworks of accountants who sort of came a cropper, literally strung up in some cases, and you get that kind of floral language these days. People say, oh, you know, bankers should be strung up and accountants, it's all their fault. Do you think that people, maybe the wider public, needs to have a better understanding of what it is that accountants do and how the numbers actually work before they make those kinds of slightly more, you know, that kind of rhetoric, that kind of more hostile pronouncements?
I'm not going to pronounce on the hostility right now. I mean, because I think things aren't great. I think that there is a lot of malfeasance going out there, although there are so many honest accountants, but I still think many accounting firms are very troubled and have, let's say, complex relationships with their clients. I do think, though, that we as societies are so financially illiterate that we're in trouble because we're forced to make these huge decisions. I mean, democracy might not always work, but we really can vote. We can push our representatives to bring in legislation and reform. But how can we do that if we can't do basic numbers? We can't even look at our own balance sheets. We can't look at giant budget calculations and make any kind of truly sensible comments or thoughts about these as a public. I think we need financial literacy if we're going to start having reforms. I mean, it's just part of the democratic process. But we're really sort of starting at a zero point right now.
One way people can get a little bit of that literacy for themselves is to read your book. Of course, it's The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Making and Breaking of Nations. It's published by Alan Lane. Jacob Soule in New York, thanks very much for joining us here on The Weekly to tell us all about it.
Thank you. A pleasure.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Photography is a medium often best associated with war reportage, made famous by icons such as Robert Capa, who captured humane moments amongst the brutality of war. As a means of recording events, it's never been easier.
But what of illustration? That more subjective, time-consuming, and less common medium for reporting on conflict zones. Our next guest has illustrated scenes from Syria, Lebanon, and Burma, to name but a few. He's had his work published across the media, and he has a new series of illustrations out soon. George Butler, welcome to the show. George, let's, before we start looking at the pictures, which are now kind of here in the studio, listeners, you'll hear our guest ruffling through them in a minute. Do you think of yourself as much a journalist as an illustrator in a way? When I think of many of the illustrators and painters and war reporters I've seen before go to conflict zones and tell more troubled stories, and I see their images, it often strikes me that they are as much reporters as the people putting words down on paper. Are you there to kind of bear witness to be a journalist in a way?
Yes, I think of myself as an illustrator, but in every image that I make or I've made recently, the story is as important for me as making it look good.
And just before I pass it over to Tom, the images that you do, you're using, it's watercolour, is it mainly, in ink?
Yes, it's a dip pen and ink.
So what's interesting for me, when we'll talk about the pictures in more specifics, but what's interesting is it's quite a gentle brushstroke and quite a light palette. We're not seeing kind of inky red splattered everywhere. It's not toughly done.
No.
Is there something that you like about that juxtaposition of, you know, the easy way that you draw and some of the tougher subjects that you're trying to tell the story about?
Well, I think it makes it more, can make it more approachable for people looking at it. And equally, at university, we're always taught to make things look beautiful, make pictures that look good. And sometimes that's difficult when you're drawing something like a war zone that doesn't necessarily look good. Having said that, there's something very reassuring, open and honest about just sitting down with a piece of paper and drawing what you see in front of you. And I think people who are looking at it respond well to it. And I think people who are part of it or might be looking over your shoulder equally sort of flattered by or interested by it.
I wanted to pick up on an element of that, which is that you see sometimes the most impactful photographic images of war zones, and you can sense the moment they're caught. So, you know, there's often an urgency. It's often very difficult to physically be in the right spot to take the image.
Absolutely.
How on earth do you do it with pen and ink? Because there is this craft. Presumably you need a sort of patience. You need a bit of time. Is there the same ability to capture that singular moment, or is it a very sort of different discipline? It must be rather difficult just physically to kind of, you know, gather all of your things about you. Or do you find that you've managed to get it down to quite a fine art, if you forgive the dreadful pun, and you have quite a lot of dexterity in how you do it?
Great pun. No, I don't think it is necessarily, in terms of a mechanical tool for capturing a moment, like some of the great photographers, Don McCullen and people like that. No, I don't think it can compete. But what these drawings are doing is offering a different angle, not a replacement at all for photography, but I hope a value dimension, just a different way of telling the story. And in cases like in Syria and Lebanon, where I was 2 weeks ago, there's many different ways of telling that story. You know, the more the better, as far as I could see.
And tell me, when you first went to Syria, obviously these latest images are from Lebanon, but how did it come about that you decided to go there?
Well, I'd always done reportage illustration having left uni and travelled a lot in places like West Africa and Azerbaijan and a few weeks in Afghanistan. And the border of Syria and Turkey seemed like a place that perhaps I could offer a different angle on. Refugees pouring across or thought to be pouring across, and their stories and where they'd come from and where they were going. And actually, when I arrived there, the situation was a bit different from what I'd imagined. And it was possible to go in and spend some time even if it was only two or three days, in my case, with the rebels and or the opposition as the media.
And now you've gone back to Lebanon, and this journey was prompted by that same narrative. You were still picking up on the repercussions of the war, or you wanted to tell a slightly different story?
Well, this trip 2 weeks ago was to the Bekaa Valley, and it was actually very different from the first time. There was no immediate signs of war, no tanks, no walking wounded, no field hospitals, things like that. In fact, it was perhaps a more common experience of the war out of Syria, and that is a million people now in Lebanon living in tented settlements, you know, 8, 9, 10 people in a tent, and then 5, 10, 15, 25 tents on the sides of the roads, in vineyards, in people's fields. And that was really what we were trying to record. I should say that this is all with a charity who were hosting me called Médecins du Monde, and they're providing primary health care out there to all these people.
Let's actually sort of delve into the images then. As Andrew mentioned, you have this lots of sheaf of incredible images with you. Talk to us about some of them. What's the one you have there? Sort of describe, paint a picture in words, if I can continue my dreadful punning, and describe to our listeners what we're looking at here.
I'll ruffle them for effect.
Absolutely. No, feel free. Go for it.
The first one is actually the first thing I drew, and it's of a mobile clinic that Médecins du Monde support. And it's basically a white van. It goes from village to village, on the outside of which are always a refugee camp. And the ongoing queues that happen when they get free medicine and try to take advantage of that. So this was the scene. Lots of people, lots of women and children in particular, kids wheeling their toys around, bicycle wheel, an old man sort of standing up close to me, just checking me out, see if it makes...
Again, I think what's striking, I think, for me when I look at these images is that there is, you know, there is something very difficult going on in this picture, of course, you know, that there is, as you say, an ambulance, there are people, the adults queuing for food. But you also add in the lighter touches, in fact, even in these difficult situations, you know, the kids are playing with makeshift toys. There is, for want of a better word, normal life going on.
Absolutely.
Even in these situations. And again, for you, I guess with a photographer would focus maybe on one person, do an image, and then, you know, another portrait. But here, you're able to show a kind of a panorama of lots of things happening in a day in the life of this encampment. Could you just tell us a little bit about that? Is that one of the benefits, in a way?
Yes, I think because you're spending an hour or 2 hours sitting in a place, because it's open, people are seeing what you're doing, you're encapsulating that period of time in one image. And so you're picking up on habits of people. So in this case, a little kid wheeling his bicycle wheel round and round, and he appears two or three times in the image. And perhaps what you're not doing is chasing a particular image for a story that you might have been asked to do, as a photographer may have been, for a story that's already been written. And I think that's what I find interesting about illustration. You're really being true to what's happening in front of you. And that's not to say photographers aren't true to what's in front of them, but I think it's a very honest way of doing it.
And I wanted to ask you about that more specifically, because obviously there's people often talk about the photographer and that separation of the story. It's very difficult. Mm. People and a lot of these communities are very aware that there's journalists or photographers who come in to document their plight. And it maybe changes their behaviour and they adjust, and maybe they will sort of interact with the photographers, and they'll maybe not pose for pictures, but there's a knowledge that they're being documented. Do you find that actually it's very different when you're working with pen and ink and paper? Do you think people sort of have a look and then they maybe drift away? Or do people still want to kind of sidle over and watch you work? What was the actual human interaction like?
Yeah, I think I probably face the same problems. I'm always comparing it to photography just because I know that's what people can relate to. Certainly for the first 5 minutes, a photographer's very good at dealing with the same issues, but certainly for the first 5 or 10 minutes, it's a novelty to having somebody, or in this part of the world, blonde hair, blue eyes, standing there drawing, because the reason for doing it is extraordinary. You know, one is completely mundane compared to what they are going through. But then after a while, they begin to recognise their friends or them or the place that they're in, and I think they appreciate it. It's not threatening.
Do they offer little tips like, come on, I've got a finer head of hair than that? Or you've not really caught the magic of...
There's always that, yeah. Or make my nose smaller or whatever, yeah.
Could you show us maybe one more image that we could talk about?
Yeah.
What are these ones? These ones of items, perhaps even something like this. What's this one?
These are, so for 7 days we were in and out of these camp settlements and people's tents, all of which we invited into. And I was trying to work out a way of telling these stories without, as you say, painting the obvious ones. And after a while, we started asking people to bring out their belongings, the belongings in particular that they bought from Syria. And I had this idea that perhaps they'd be precious or, you know, hold some serious sentimental value, perhaps things they'd been given. And in reality, they were the things that they grabbed when the lights went off, or that they were in the kids' hands when they got caught at the checkpoint, or they collected from the rubble of their homes in some of the cases here. And to anybody else or to me, they were just a lot of it was junk. But to them, so here we've got a key ring, which they used to hang the keys on in their house, their salon in Syria, a wedding photo, a souvenir they'd bought when they went on a family holiday to Dubai. And these were things that they just sort of grabbed and put in a box and unpacked when they got here. Some of them completely useless. There's a TV control for the TV in Syria, which they now just can't bring themselves to throw away because it's all they have of that.
Such a sort of sorrowful quality. I just wondered, both in terms of these, which are pictures of, as you mentioned, a series of items sort of in isolation, and in the bigger works as well, even the landscapes, there's a sort of a focus in on particular things, splashes of colour and areas of white where, as you mentioned, a guy standing right in the foreground and he's very prominent. Do you sort of draw sort of as you see? Is it from memory? I mean, it's funny, you think back to things and you have particular things that flash into your mind particularly prominently. Do you try and sort of almost capture that imagination in the works as well?
Yeah, I always draw from life, so standing at the scene, but I'm also aware that a lot of the information in front of me doesn't help tell a story. So things like foreground or lots of trees in the background or thousands of people might not tell the story of a particular person or however it unfolds. So I'm very aware that things might move, and I think that liveliness as things unfold, people moving, people talking, coming and going, is just a way of capturing the scene.
Perhaps finally you could tell our listeners how they could potentially see some of these images. Are they online? Are they going to be in an exhibition? What's the life of these pictures going to be now that you've come back?
So now that I'm back in England, I'm going to try and have them published. Places like, the places that I had them published before, The Guardian and on the BBC. And following that, we're going to have an exhibition for one night in the V&A, hosted by Médecins du Monde. And that's on the 20th of June. So there'll be an opportunity to see them there as well.
Fantastic. Well, we shall heartily recommend it to our listeners. George Butler, thanks very much for coming in with your sheaf of papers and sharing all your work with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That, I believe, and I think some people will be rather delighted to know, is all we've got for edition 251 of the Monocle Weekly.
I don't think they'll be delighted, Andrew. I think they'll be slightly sad.
Okay.
What an hour it's been.
Do you know it's you and me next week as well?
I know, that's quite exciting, isn't it?
We've got rid of that Robert Bauer. I don't know where he's going next week. He's always got an excuse these
days.
He's the
quintessential jet setter.
Yes. He jet setted to the Netherlands this week. I'm not sure if that's quite jet setting. That's more a little hop, isn't it?
To be fair, it's not that jet setting. Where was he? Mogadishu before that?
Yes, but that's for a very good story that's in the next issue of Monocle.
Just tantalise the listeners with that one.
He wasn't there for his holidays. He was there for an interesting transport story.
It's one to watch out for, I think.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Me too. Very much so, Andrew.
And we had some very nice guests. George, he did as was told. He brought in some nice paper.
We had artworks. We had
a nice book.
Literary masterpieces. We were pretty well served this week. Maybe next week we can get a bit more experimental.
And you learn some accountancy terms.
Absolutely.
Which we'll be using later.
Absolutely. I'll be rolling those out probably from this Sunday evening. We'll be talking double entry tonight.
Okay. And that is it. Are you going to say the goodbyes?
Yeah, I should. Well, let's give our thanks, first of all, to our producer, Alec John, and our studio manager, Claire Aban.
And from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
There's just time to say goodbye. See you next week.